Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show. You can listen, of course, live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1. And it really is the best of the best today. Coming up on the podcast today, yes, we've got Rishi Sunak, but we've also got Harry Hill as well. Rishi Sunak and Harry Hill, both natty dressers, if nothing else. So that's coming up in just a moment. First, though, as ever, we kick off with our columnist panel. And on a Friday, it's Formel. It's Melanie Reed and James Forsyth.
The columnists with Formel. James Forsyth and Melanie Reed on Times Radio.
Yes, as usual on a Friday morning, we speak to our two favourite columnists, Melanie Reed and James Forsyth. Morning, Melanie.
Morning, Matt.
Nice to have you with us. Then we've also got James. Morning, James.
Morning, Matt. How are you doing?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Bit hot and bothered, what with the weather and whatnot. But, you know, we're all right. We're all right.
Are you pro-heat or anti-heat?
I used to like the heat, and now I've had enough heat. Heat and eat it or something. James, let's talk about your column today, because you've sort of zeroed in on Nicola Sturgeon. I mean, one of my favourite moments of the week was Nicola Sturgeon hitting back at Liz Truss. Liz Truss calling her an attention seeker, and Nicola Sturgeon revealing that the one time she spoke to Liz Truss, she asked how she could get her into Vogue. But once again, it puts us, which as the attention seeking quotes, Tory MPs have told me from both camps have said that that's gone down like an absolute cup of warm sick in Scotland. But your point is that actually, Nicola Sturgeon, you know, both candidates need to be focusing on her and try to keep the union together.
Yeah, because, I mean, everyone's, I think we are about to see, when the Supreme Court hears the case on the legality or otherwise of the Scottish government's attempt to hold a second independence referendum, it's going to push independence right back up the agenda. And I still think that one of the other points that we can too often forget in Westminster is that, you know, post 2014, the nationalists start within striking distance in any second campaign, and therefore, you know, the union is at greater risk than it was before. Now, I think there are some kind of lessons in terms of how you deal with Nicola Sturgeon that you can actually kind of learn from where Boris Johnson got to by the end of his premiership. And I think one of them is, you know, they are more riled by cooperation than confrontation. And the great advantage that the Westminster government has over the Scottish government is that the Scottish nationalists inherently don't want devolution to work, whereas the Westminster government can want it to work. And I think if you look at the Scottish electorate, what those crucial voters who are going to decide any second independence referendum want is they want to see the two governments working together. And so I think that, you know, the UK government should always aim to be the reasonable one doing that. And then the other thing that the UK government should be doing is don't get into a definition of what's a generation or not, or say you can never have another referendum. Just emphasise, and I think particularly will be true this October, that, you know, this is a weird priority at this moment in time. The whole of the continent of Europe is about to be plunged into a crisis by Vladimir Putin's use of the energy weapon. I don't see how you can possibly argue that independence would solve that problem, and emphasise that it's an odd priority right now. Now is not the time. It's a much better argument than never.
Manny, you are in Scotland, so you can give us a perspective from there. What did you make of James's argument in his column today, and the approach or otherwise from the two major candidates towards Nicola Sturgeon and Scotland?
James is absolutely right. You have to box very, very. Westminster has to box very, very clever with Scotland. The SNP, you know, they're masters at guerrilla warfare. They're very, very clever and crafty. And anything that Westminster does, they will turn to turn it into the age old SNP grievance narrative. You know, that Westminster disrespects us and tramples on us and bullies us and ignores us. And that is, you know, that's what keeps independence voters geared up. I think Nicola Sturgeon's position is both strong and not strong. You know, she has an undoubted electoral mandate to rule, because she's the SNP have controlled the Scottish Parliament since 2007. But it's not strong in the sense that she didn't manage to get a majority in the last time round, and the polls are still extraordinarily close. I mean, I think it's been a while since the last poll, but they move, they shift, they move anything between sort of 47-53%. There hasn't been any sort of recently any big series of polls over the 50%. And the argument has always been that, you know, if you want to go for a referendum and you want to win it in a clear way, you need at least 60%.
Yeah.
And you're foolish unless you wait.
But I suppose the point, James's point, is they came from a long way behind last time. If they pulled off the same trick again, then that would be easier. James, the other thing I think sometimes, and this definitely came through with that joke from Liz Truss saying that Nicola Sturgeon was an attention seeker, could be ignored. You can't ignore her, because whether you agree with her or not, Nicola Sturgeon is a long-serving politician. She's also very, very good at politics. And actually, you could argue, better at politics than either of the two people currently running to be Prime Minister.
Well, you have to respect someone who's now onto their fourth Prime Minister, right? That is no small achievement. And I think you saw in that interview she did with Ian Dale at the Edinburgh Festival that, you know, she will return any insult with interest. And so don't get into that kind of argument with her. It's not going to end well. I think it is much better to all... But I think, actually, Melanie made the point, you know, that there actually are uncanny similarities between the SNP and the Tories at the moment. You know, they've been in power for a long time. And when parties have been in power for generally more than a decade, they find it hard to come up with new ideas, and they find it hard to shake off scandals. I mean, they're undercovered in the London press. But, you know, the SNP have been hit by a series of scandals that are not entirely dissimilar to the ones that the Tories have been hit by in recent months. And so I think if you can find a way to look like the reasonable ones, then I think that makes things more difficult for the SNP. And as Melanie said, you know, Nicola Sturgeon, in some ways, if the Supreme Court tells her she can have this referendum because it has absolutely no legal relevance at all, she'll be forced in October 2023, which will still be a time when energy prices are very high, a very difficult time for people. She'll be forced to go through with a referendum, but I suspect that most unionists in Scotland will simply boycott.
Yeah.
And I mean, that will leave her looking a bit absurd.
And the implication, too, is that if it's an unofficial referendum, it'll be regarded, you know, like the Catalan one. And there will be an absolute boycott of the unionists will boycott it totally. That she also runs the risk of alienating the European Union. You know, she wants to get back in the EU. The EU weren't terribly happy
with
the Catalan.
That's a very good point, the Catalan. Yeah. That she needs to avoid those comparisons.
Absolutely.
Let's move on and talk about the, if she's the woman of the moment, the man of the last moment. Boris Johnson is taking he's calling the lawyers, Boris Johnson. He's taking legal advice now over the Privileged Committee investigation, as those close to him accept it as a foregone conclusion that we found in contempt of Parliament. Liz Truss has said that she'd try and get it voted out so that he wouldn't even face it. There's a slightly undignified end to it all, isn't it, James?
Yeah. I think the problem is that what Boris Johnson will need to explain to a committee is if you inadvertently mislead the House, you're meant to correct the record at the first available opportunity. And I think what he would need to explain is why that didn't happen. Now, I think to be fair to him, you can argue that it was complicated by the fact that, you know, if he had come and sought to correct the record at the first available opportunity, you know, people would have said that he was prejudging the Sue Gray report, but, you know, he was making it too difficult for her to do her work. But I think he needs to explain that more clearly. I think he has also not been helped, frankly, by Nadine Dorris and people like that launching all these kind of full-throated attacks on the committee. I mean, I think if when Bernard Jenkin is normally a relatively mild-mannered man, but when he is complaining about terrorist tactics, I think it suggests that it has backfired. I think it would have been much better to have had a as with so many of the problems that Boris Johnson got into in the final months of his premiership, you know, a bit of contrition and a more conciliatory tone, and things might have turned out very differently.
Melanie, what do you think?
I find it very funny. I mean, you know, from a distance, it's you know, great narcissists don't want to lose the stage, do they? They just really don't want to go.
Maybe what he needs is for the FBI to go into number 10 and start looking for bits of paper that he's got to try and prove that would be the perfect parallel.
Extraordinary parallel, isn't it? I mean, he's so Trumpian in a very sort of mild British way.
In a sort of mild tribute act rather than, rather than full-throated.
Totally.
Extraordinary.
Isn't there another irony in that, you know, he's desperately trying to save his seat, but isn't he almost definitely going to lose it at the next election? I mean, it's...
There's an argument for saying, well, why doesn't he just go before that? But then, you know, he would trigger a by-election, they'd lose the seat. That probably wouldn't do his popularity amongst Tory party members much good, given that. But most of these hustings, James, the biggest round of applause seem to have been for mentions of Boris Johnson.
Yeah, look, there is clearly somewhere between, depending on which poll you want to use, somewhere between a third and half of Tory members who wish he was still there. And I think that is going to be problematic for whoever succeeds him, because people will start saying, well, where is he? You know, what about having him back? Because, you know, I think one of the things that we aren't quite grasping yet, because it is almost beyond our comprehension, is just how difficult and hard this winter is going to be.
Yeah, and that's coming down the track.
I think that we don't quite realise how interconnected all these crises are. You know, you have energy bills coming in at over £4,000 for the average household. You know, there are a huge number of pensioners who will respond to that by turning the heat in their house right down. That is inadvertently going to lead to more pressure on the NHS as more people get chest infections, more people get sick from the cold. And that's going to put more pressure on the NHS, which, you know, if you look at the stats that came out yesterday, and, you know, if you asked a proverbial visitor from Mars what month of the year they were for, they would assume that they were for a really bad February. They're actually for a very sunny July. And I think this is the kind of the way in which everything is serving to make everything else worse is, I think, the thing that we haven't all quite clocked onto yet.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it on that upbeat, cheery note, James. But sorry, thank you for that.
Enjoy the lovely weather today.
James Forsyth and Melanie Reid then. Of course, you can read them in The Times every week. James on a Friday, Melanie on a Saturday. You can read me in The Times on a Saturday as well, if you want to. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next is Rishi Sunak.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, clearly the Tory leadership contest is rolling on. We've been trying to get the contenders on for ages. We finally got one of them. This is what happened when I spoke to Rishi Sunak.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Yeah, so Tory leadership contender Rishi Sunak has unveiled a three-part plan to ease the pain of soaring energy bills. Writing in the Times today, he's promising to provide the support required to the people who need it. Well, what does all that mean in practice? We can find out right now here on Times Radio. I'm joined live by the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak. Good morning.
Hi, Matt. It's Rishi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I can hear you loud and clear. You slightly panicked me there. There was a short gap, but we've got you. That's good news. That's good news. We'll come on to energy bills in a moment, but clearly your most recent job as Chancellor of the Exchequer was to oversee the economy. The latest GDP figures out today show the economy shrank by 0.1%. The Bank of England says it's only going to get worse over the next year. Is this the start of your recession?
Well, it's pretty clear that the numbers show that inflation is the clear and present danger to the economy. That's what I've been saying for weeks, and it's why the next Prime Minister needs to have a plan to grip inflation and should make it the number one priority. That's what I've been saying for a while. These numbers demonstrate that that's the case. So it's important that we support people this winter with energy bills in particular, because we know it's going to be really tough. And I've just been writing in your paper about exactly my plans to do that. And then we need to have a good plan to grow the economy, where my tax reforms this autumn will get businesses investing and innovating, because that's how you grow the economy in the long run. That's the right plan. And pursuing policies that will make inflation worse and last longer, I don't think are the right thing for the country. And that's what I'm talking to people about everywhere I go.
But you were these figures, the economy shrank in the 3 months to June. You were Chancellor then. Liz Truss says she's got the policies to stop a recession. Why didn't your policies stop the economy shrinking in your last 3 months as Chancellor?
Well, because we're suffering from inflation, as are many countries around the world. And I'm sure you'll be talking to the Chancellor himself about these figures as well. But all I can say is I have been saying for a while that inflation is the danger to the economy. Now, a good chunk of that has come from the result of global energy prices. But the thing we need to now do is look forward. Inflation is forecast to get a lot worse. And I don't think it's sensible in that environment to pump £50 billion worth of borrowed money into the economy, because that's a big gamble with people's mortgage rates, their savings, their pensions. Inflation could get even worse and last longer. I don't want to do that. I want to help people with the cost of living, particularly those who really need our help over what is going to be a difficult autumn and winter, and then do sensible tax reform that is going to make sure that businesses invest more, innovate more. That's what my radical tax plans do, because I know my experience in business, my time as Chancellor, has told me that that is the way that we are going to drive up growth and productivity in this country, because that's what we all want to see. That's how we're going to reduce inflation. That's how we're going to create jobs that pay people well. And my plan is the right one to do that.
Let's talk about your plan then today on your cost of living plan. You write in the Times that you would do more to help with rising energy bills. The main concrete promise is to cut VAT from bills worth £200 to every household. To every household, which means everyone will get it. I mean, bluntly, honestly, I don't need £200. You don't need £200. Why are you and I going to get £200 when some people in this country can't afford to heat their own dinner?
Because the vast majority of people, Matt, are going to need some help, because the bills are going up at such a rate that many people, even in decent jobs with a decent wage, are going to feel the pinch. And I think it's right that everyone gets some support. And it's very hard to find ways to do that quickly and efficiently to benefit the vast majority of people whilst excluding a few people at the top, which if it was possible to do, of course I'd prefer to do that. But you've got to deal with what is practical in government, and that is a good lever that we can pull that gets lots of support to lots of people quickly. But on top of that, you are right. There are two groups of other people who will need more help. People on very low incomes and pensioners. Now, Liz Truss's tax plans do virtually nothing for those people. And I don't think that's right, because they will need direct financial support. They don't have an easy way of increasing their incomes. They're going to face a really difficult winter, and the compassionate, conservative thing to do is to provide those people with direct assistance. And that's what I will do as Prime Minister. I announced some as Chancellor, and as Prime Minister, I would go further because the situation is worse than we thought. That's the right thing to do.
We asked listeners to send in questions. We had a lot of, clearly, as you imagine, lots of questions on this topic. One listener, Ben, made exactly this point about why are well-off people getting this support. He asked, is there not a mechanism for people to be able to give it back? To say, well, I don't need this support, and I know that other people do. Is that something that the government is capable of that you would consider doing?
No, look, everyone will be able to make their own decisions, and I'm sure if they want to give that money to charity, they're more than welcome to do so.
But would you give yours, everyone else is asking. Would you give your £200 to charity?
I already said, Matt, that I would do that. And the thing is, though, we tried a version of it earlier in the year where we tried to use the council tax system to get help to the vast majority of people, that not people who were in the most wealthy households. And actually, when we did that, what did we do? We heard a lot from all the people who were just the other side of the line, who said, hang on, I might be living in a big house, but actually I'm not earning a lot of money and I do need help. And what are you going to do for me? So it's hard to get these things perfectly right. But when you've got a situation of this scale, where the vast majority of people do need some help, then you have to pull this lever. And I'm not going to make any apologies about that, because actually, having been in government, you have to focus on what works. And if I become Prime Minister at the beginning of September, bills are going to go up just a few weeks after that. I want to make sure that I can do something that provides immediate help to millions and millions of families. And that is one of the very few, if not only, levers available. I'm not going to pretend it's perfect. Of course it's not. But that is the best thing to do. I'm very happy if someone's got an alternative that I haven't thought of. They're more than welcome to let me know. But having looked at all the options, I know that that is the best one, combined with extra help for the most vulnerable people, whether it's pensioners or those on low income. And we have established mechanisms for doing that. And as Chancellor, as I said I would use those. And as Prime Minister, I will go further, because those are the people who are going to most need help this winter.
You've said previously in the campaign that the answer to too much borrowing isn't more borrowing. Saying it was irresponsible for Liz Truss to promise that. How are you going to pay for this additional help for bills that you set out in the Times today?
Well, as I set out there, right, there's the first thing to do is to recognise that this is the number one priority of government at the moment, and we should look very hard at all other areas of public spending to find efficiencies. Now, I've proven that I can do that. As Chancellor, I went and found over £1 billion to send to Ukraine just recently when we wanted to continue supporting
their
efforts.
Yeah, but how are you going to pay for this? How are you going to pay for this
money,
bills support?
Well, that's what I'm saying. When we need to, I've demonstrated an ability to find savings and efficiencies across government spending to fund things of this type of magnitude. Beyond that, as Chancellor, I introduced something called the Energy Profits Levy, because I didn't think it was right that because of a war, energy companies were going to make considerably excessive profits. I didn't think that was fair. And so in these exceptional circumstances, I introduced a new levy on those profits, and we can use that money to help reduce people's bills. I think that is a reasonable and fair thing to do in these exceptional times.
But you've spent that money. You've already spent that money. I'm talking about
because we're now dealing with a situation that is worse than we thought, because prices are higher than we thought, but you introduced the windfall tax
to pay for the last massive amount of spending. I'm asking about this £10 billion.
Right. So what's happened since then, Matt, is that that levy is almost certainly likely to raise more money, because the situation is worse with energy prices and they're higher. So that levy will automatically raise more money, which we can use. And that was why I did it, because it means that if this war carries on, if prices are higher, then as those excessive profits are being made, the government will be able to recoup those and more of those as prices rise and use those to defray people's bills. I think that's the right thing to do. And I think Liz Truss last night said she opposed doing that and actually didn't believe in that policy. So I think that's a question for her to answer. I think that's the fair thing to do. So it's easy for me to say, yes, I can have the money to pay for these things, because I put in place a mechanism that actually raises money from the energy companies to do so.
You talk about how you can find savings from public services. I think that will surprise lots of people listening to this. Do you think that after 12 years of Conservative government, there's money being wasted somewhere in public services? In fact, during the campaign, you've said that you don't think the NHS is working properly, the welfare system isn't working properly, the immigration system isn't working properly, regional development isn't working properly, the economy is heading for a recession, and we're struggling to find the money to help people right now. Why is it that after 12 years of Conservative government, we're in this situation where, far from being able to find money from public services, the public services are on their knees in this country?
Well, my plan is to start reforming them. But right? And that's why I've set out a plan, whether it's on NHS.
Well, but whose fault is it? After 12 years, you've been an MP for half that time. You've been in the cabinet for 2 years. Whose fault is it that the Coventry's public services are on their knees now?
Right. So, look, yes, I have been in the cabinet for the last 2 years. I was Chancellor during the biggest economic shock that this country had faced in 300 years. And I'm really proud of my record of ensuring that our economy and jobs and businesses were carried through it and remained resilient in the face of that shock. That's my track record as Chancellor, stewarding our economy through some incredibly challenging times. But look, I'm looking at the future. Right. And what people need to know now is, if this guy's prime minister, what is he going to do? Well, I tell you, I've got a plan to reform the NHS, to do things boldly and differently. For example, tackling this issue of missed appointments, because that is a sensible reforming thing to do, which means we'll get more productivity and healthcare out of the NHS without putting more money in. But when it comes to illegal migration, I've set out a very clear 10-point plan that will hopefully tackle that.
Let's just focus on the NHS. The problem with the NHS isn't people missing appointments. It's too many people turning up sick and needing help. You expended a lot of political capital introducing the NHS levy last year, the increase in national insurance. And yet today we've got figures, and this was supposed to be clearing up the backlogs in the NHS. 1,000 patients a day are having to wait at least 12 hours in A&E. What happened to all that money? What happened to that plan that we only had 6 months ago?
Yeah, well, so I'm interested in reforming the NHS, because it's all very well putting the money in, and that's right. And it was right to support the NHS to recover from a pandemic and to work our way through the backlogs. But that's not sufficient. You need someone who's going to actually be prepared to actually reform things, to change them, because we can't constantly keep putting more money in. We've actually got to be more efficient with public services. That's what my plan does. And I completely disagree with you that the issue is not missed appointments. 15 million appointments every year are missed. And that is not only not valuing our doctors properly, it's depriving many people of the care that they desperately and urgently need. Now, if we can change culture, this is not about making money from fines, this is about changing the culture where that becomes much less acceptable. Because if people cancel those appointments in advance, it frees up much more of doctors' time to treat more people faster. We're going to get the backlogs down quicker, more people are going to get the care they need, and we won't have spent another penny because we're already paying for all that time. So that's an example of something that's different, something that's bold, that could make a huge difference to the quality of the healthcare that we're going to get out of the NHS. So actually, that's just one example of one of the things I want to do, but I want to bring that kind of bold approach, radical approach to reforming public services, tackling these challenges that you rightly identified. That's what I want to do as Prime Minister. That's why I'm in this race.
Let's talk about one of the things that everybody in the country is talking about right now, the heat wave, the drought that's happening. There's a hosepipe ban introduced in your part of the world, in Yorkshire, where you're an MP. How's that going to affect you? Are you gardening? How's the swimming pool?
I'm spending virtually no time at home because I'm out on a campaign. So if you think about what I'm doing, I mean, where am I today? I started the day in Oxfordshire and Henley. Now I'm in Windsor and Maidenhead. Then I'm going to Ruislip. Then I'm in West London. Then I'm in Wimbledon. And then I'm all the way down in Chichester. So that's where I'm spending my days. That's what a campaign is about. I'm out and about. But look, obviously this drought is very serious. I know the Environment Agency is working with farmers in particular that I care about. I have lots of farmers near my own home who will be concerned about all these things. And it actually shines a light on what we need to do, which is make sure our water companies are fulfilling all their obligations to us in correcting leaks. Because what's not acceptable is if we have an enormous amount of water wasted through leakage and indeed polluting our rivers, that's just not right. And we need to make sure we have a regulatory regime and a set of laws, which we've recently passed in Parliament, that can mean that we can properly hold those water companies to account, find them when they're not doing the right thing. And that hasn't happened clearly sufficiently in the past. The new powers allow us to do that. And I want to make sure as Prime Minister that we use them to fix this problem.
Do you think we all need to change how we use water as well? Because clearly everyone becomes an expert in saving water when there's a drought like this. But sort of around the year, do we need to change the way we use water, to use less water?
Well, I think actually we're losing, as I understand it, huge amounts of water through leakage. And actually, if we can fix that, that's why I was talking about the water companies doing the right things about investing in infrastructure, stopping unnecessary, preventable leaks, then that would be a really good thing. And we need to make sure that we hold them account to doing that. But also at the same time, making sure that our rivers are not being polluted with sewage that's being released from all these pipes. So as I said, we've got a new set of powers that allow us to find them and hold them to account for doing that. As Prime Minister, I'd want to use them to improve the situation.
I want to ask you about Brexit. Obviously, we've got a lot of things we want to get through. You've said in your campaign that you would keep Brexit safe. Would Brexit be unsafe under a Remainer like Liz Truss?
Look, I'm just going to talk about what I'm going to do. As I said, I was proud to vote for Brexit, and I believe that we can make an enormous success of it. And as Chancellor, I demonstrated that, right? Because you've got to do things differently. So I came up with the idea for free ports, which are it's special zones around the country that attract jobs and investment, which we couldn't do properly inside the EU. I came up with that idea as a backbench MP, and as a Chancellor, I've delivered it, and it's working. When it comes to financial services, which is part of my own professional background, I was about to introduce a bill in Parliament working with my colleague John Glenn, who's been a superb minister, where we were going to radically reform all our financial services regulation to make sure that the UK remains the most competitive, dynamic place for financial services anywhere in the world. And what I want to see is that same radicalism across government, right? So whether it's in clinical trials and life sciences and data and AI and agri-tech, there's an enormous amount of opportunity out there for us to create the innovation economy that we need to drive growth in today's age if we're going to be prepared to be bold about it. And what I did as Chancellor in my department, I want to replicate across government because that's how we're going to make a big success of this.
On a specific, Niall sent in a message, wanting to know what you're going to do about the Northern Ireland Protocol, because this row has gone on and on and on for 6 years. If we are outside the EU and outside the single market and outside the customs union, there has to be a border somewhere. And if we're committed to the Good Friday Agreement, that border can't be between Britain and Northern Ireland. So doesn't it then have to be between, sorry, the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland? Doesn't the border then have to be between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK? What is your plan to sort out the Northern Ireland Protocol?
Well, look, quite simply at the moment, the economy of Northern Ireland is being pulled out of the orbit of the rest of the economy of the United Kingdom, and that's wrong. Whether your grandmother trying to send a birthday present to your granddaughter in Northern Ireland, whether you're trying to take your pet on holiday, whether you're a supermarket trying to sell your sandwiches in all parts of the United Kingdom, you know, these things shouldn't be that difficult. They don't infringe on the integrity of the single market, and we need to fix them. So the bill that's in Parliament is one that I support that will address them, but it will take time. So I hope as a new Prime Minister, I can also sit down and have a constructive relationship with both the Irish, French and European governments to make sure that we can try and see if we can find a constructive solution to this problem, not least because it would mean we could solve it far faster than the time it takes the bill to get through Parliament. But people should be in no doubt. It's wrong what is happening. The Northern Ireland economy should, of course, be an integral part of the UK economy. It shouldn't be sucked out. And I will make sure that that doesn't happen as PM.
I want to ask you a bit about the campaign and how it's going. Are you really still in this? This is not already a foregone conclusion. All the polls suggest that Liz Truss is miles ahead. Why are you traipsing around going to... I lost count, actually, the number of places you're going to today. Why are you still traipsing around the country doing this?
Because I'm fighting passionately for the things that I believe are best for this country. And the reception I'm getting everywhere I go is positive. People are responding well. And I think I've got, you know, a fantastic chance to make progress in this campaign. And all the polls don't say that, actually, Matt. There was a poll of councillors the other day, and there have hardly been any polls, to be honest, but there was a poll of councillors which showed it was completely evenly split between me and Liz Truss and people who don't know. And that's the point. Actually, you've probably seen some of these hustings. You know, you ask people who's made up their mind. Lots of people have not made up their mind. So, you know, I'm going to go out and fight very hard for every vote. I'm giving it everything I've got, as you can see, across the country. And I'm going to do that till the last day of this campaign.
I have been watching a lot of the hustings. I know you've said you'd take a job in Liz Truss's cabinet, were it to go the other way. I'm quite intrigued as to why. You've said that her plans are not morally the right thing to do. How could you possibly serve in her cabinet or even vote through her plans if you don't think they're morally the right thing to do?
Yeah, well, look, all this focus on jobs and all the rest of it is not really what I think anyone is focused on, right? What they're focused on is, look, what are you going to do for the country? And I've been very clear about what I want to do for the country. I think it is important that we get a grip of inflation. I think it's important that we help the most vulnerable people through what is going to be a difficult autumn and winter. And I think it's important that we have someone who can get to grips with the challenges we face on things like the NHS and tackling illegal migration and making sure that our economy and education system is fit for the future. Now, I'm really excited about delivering that vision. I want us to build an economy that is incredibly dynamic, where our young people have access to all the opportunities and skills they need. And your Education Commission did a superb job at highlighting some of the changes we need to make, actually, that I'd love to have a chance to put into practice, whether it's looking at curriculum reform at 18 to broaden it out, whether it's looking at more technical education in partnership with businesses for young people and adults. Like, those are all things that I want to get on and deliver that will help us build a better country, and critically for our members as well. Right, it's important to think, well, who can go and beat Keir Starmer in the next election? I'm confident that I'm the person who can appeal to swing voters everywhere and deliver that election victory for the Conservative Party.
Which, I know we're very, very, very short on time. You've very kindly said you're going to do the quiz. One last question I want to ask you about. You gave the Conservative MP Mark Fletcher £5,000 to pay for a constituency dinner. He's repaid your generosity by backing Liz Truss. Are you annoyed about that?
No, not at all. It's because I had to cancel at the last minute an event that I'd promised I would do for him, and people had paid for that, and I didn't think that was right, and I wanted to make sure that those people were not out of pocket because they had come to speak to me and I couldn't be there, and I felt an obligation to make good on that promise. So, and that was my way of doing it, because it was, you know, I've never really had to ever cancel something like that, but it was, I think it was the day that I had sadly left government and resigned. So and I just wanted to make sure that those people were not out of pocket.
That was Rishi Sunak. Now, this is my chat with Harry Hill. Matt Chorley on Times Radio, now joined by, well, I don't know, comedian, playwright, artist, author.
Yeah.
Where do we begin? Harry Hill, welcome to Times Radio.
Yeah. World famous Pratt. Well, thank you very much. Yes, and what a pleasure it is to talk to you, Matt.
So where's,
what
where's
am
we,
I? Yes.
Where should what we start? What should we start with? Which bit of your existence do we want to start? Let's talk about art. You've been talking about art this week. You've been launching public art across London. Tell us what you've been doing.
Yeah, well, I'm involved with Art for London, Art of London. I keep saying Art for London. Actually, Art for London is a much better name for it. Art of London, Brighter Future, which is a public exhibition in London's fashionable West End. So they got me involved in choosing some, I mean, a crazy idea to get me involved in choosing some of the artists. There was a panel of judges, of which I was one. So we've got Sam Williams, Fiona Quadri, and Zara Hussein, three up-and-coming artists who have got this fantastic opportunity to have some of their art in these iconic places. So Piccadilly Circus, St. James's Churchyard, St. James's Market, and then there are other places coming up along the line.
And explain what they are. Also, I know we're on the radio and we're doing visual art, but explain, if you can, what you've chosen, why you've chosen, what it looks like.
Yeah, the other incentive was that they said they'd include some of my artwork as well. You know, I'm a hobby artist. I'm an amateur artist myself. So I have done these aliens, these green aliens, which you can bump into along the way. And if you, they have a QR code, which you can scan on your smartphone, and a little alien will appear through the other, you know, the proper artist's work. So so Fiona Quadri, I mean, difficult to describe them on the radio, isn't it? They're kind of brightly coloured. She uses a kind of odd backward writing in it. There's Sam Williams, which is a kind of a theme parky type feel. So they're kind of interactive. You can kind of climb all over them. And then Zara Hussein, she's an Islamic, she did an MA in Islamic art. And so there's a kind of, it's a kind of repetitive pattern based on Islamic art, which is, well, it's brightly coloured. It's
kind really of, if you came along it in the street, you'd think, oh, what's that? I want to go and look at it and see what about.
Well, I think that is a big, I mean, joking apart, I think that is a big part of public art, is that, you know, you can be on your way to the office and just walk past something and think, oh, that's nice, and hopefully we'll just, you know, put a spring in your step, a smile on your face at the very least, and who knows, it might even make you think, oh yeah, I could do that, go home and pick up a paintbrush or a chisel and start doing your own stuff.
And you say that you're an amateur artist. You're doing yourself down a bit, Harry. I mean, I've definitely seen you on, you've been on Grayson's Art Club. That's a proper,
well, anyone can get on that, anyone can get on Grayson's Art Club.
Did you have paintings in the Tate Modern? I've definitely seen a picture of you, that you've done of a golden retriever.
It's true. It wasn't the Tate, if only. It was the Royal Academy Summer Exhibition. So, yeah, I have had, over the years, I've been in that exhibition maybe four times. And I've always managed to sell whatever it was that I had in. So, yeah, but I don't make any claims for myself. I mean, I think, you know, actually, talk about popularizing art, I think Grayson's Art Club has done a fantastic job for that. You know, particularly, I mean, it took the lockdown probably to make people think, to give people the time to actually get round to doing it. You know, there's a weird kind of thing where as kids, we all do art. You know, if you put a crayon in a kid's hand, they'll start drawing. But we become, just around kind of teenage years, you start becoming self-conscious. And a lot of people, if you say to them, oh, draw me a picture of a fruit bowl, or draw me what you can see out of your window, they feel very self-conscious and embarrassed about what they produce. And what I'm kind of saying, and I think Grayson probably says the same, is that it doesn't really matter what you produce. It's about doing it. It's just about doing it, because there's an enormous amount of satisfaction about immersing yourself in something other than what you do for a living.
Well, that's Harry, I need to talk to you about what else should we talk about? Let's talk about Tony Blair. Can I ask you about Tony Blair?
Okay, great.
I came to see the Tony Blair. Yeah, rock opera.
Well, God bless you. God bless you. You were lucky to get a ticket. It was weird. The first week, we couldn't give tickets away. And then suddenly, I don't know if it was word of mouth or we had a couple of favourable reviews. And suddenly it was like all my friends who, I would say, oh, yeah, I've got this musical. Would you like to come? They were saying, I've got something. Suddenly they were all on the phone saying, any chance of a ticket?
Well, I think it's all because we had Steve Brown, your co-conspirator in this. He came out, I think it was all because he came on Times Radio, and then the tickets flew out the door. Explain why you decided to write a musical about the life and times of Tony Blair. And because I have to say, I also saw the X Factor musical, which I loved, which I'm aware was not a universal reaction back when it was at the London.
Well, I think actually, it's funny because actually we got good reviews. You know, it wasn't a critical flop in the way that it was a financial one. I think what it was, Matt, is that we found this perfect storm, which was, there's one group of people who really like the X Factor, and there's one group of people who really like musicals, but all the people that like the X Factor don't like musicals, and people who like musicals don't like the X Factor. It was just a really bad idea.
Which you wouldn't have thought. On paper you'd have thought, but they like people warbling away on stage.
I tell you, Matt, when I came up with the idea and when Simon Cowell said, it's a yes for me, I thought I was going to be rich. I mean, I thought, it was, if you think about X Factor in 2012 was like the biggest TV show. The tabloids were, every day there'd be another story. And it was on in 86 countries around the world. I thought this show could be simultaneously running in New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Moscow, Reykjavik. You know, I mean, you started doing the maths as I started to. But I know, joking apart, I think basically no one has ever opened a new musical or even a new play at the London Palladium. And I think everyone got slightly carried away with the whole kind of machismo and bravado of the whole, Simon Cowell circus. And if we'd opened, because we were selling enough tickets to sell out a medium-sized theatre, if we'd opened in the Lyric Shaftesbury Avenue, it would have been sold out every night. You know, it was a weird thing.
I enjoyed
weird
it.
Thing,
I thought it was, part of me loved seeing it. Sort of, because sometimes having followed you for a long time now, your comedy is quite bespoke, artisan. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like some of your, the props and things, they look like they could see that you've made them. So taking that mentality and then blowing huge sums of Simon Cowell's money on it and putting it on the biggest stage in London.
Yeah,
really,
I know.
That appealed to my sense of the ridiculous.
Well, it appealed to mine. I mean, I was sort of actually all the way through that process, I was sort of laughing to myself, thinking I can't actually. Well, I remember we came out of the meeting with Simon Cowell in his office in Kensington, and he'd said, yes, it's a yes from me. We came out onto the street, we looked at each other and we said, you're actually going to have to do this now. we couldn't actually believe. I basically came up with the idea drunk in front of watching the X Factor final 2011, with when Little Mix lifted the lifted the prize. So, no one was more surprised than I.
So then it's been a while then for you to get over the what happened with the X Factor one. So then you chose.
Well, I tell you, Matt, no one would touch us after that. No one would touch us. We'd lost so much money. no one would touch us. And I had the, I've had the idea for that. I wrote the original script for the Tony Blair thing about maybe 6 years ago. The opening night at the of the workshop, I went on to introduce the thing. And I said, you know, our first musical opened at the London Palladium, 2,400 seats. And you know, as you know, the Park Theatre is 200 seats. You know, we are where we are. it was...
And what was it about, for people who don't know, what was it about Tony Blair?
Well, it's just a great, you know, it's a great story. It's operatic, really, in its arc, its story arc. You know, he starts off as a kind of peace-loving hippie. He's in a rock band. He's got long hair. You know, he's singing in Ugly Rumours. He's obsessed with Mick Jagger. And then, you know, he becomes the most successful Labour Prime Minister of all time. He's swept to kind of, and literally swept to victory. You remember those scenes of people lining the streets? I mean, they may well have been paid, I don't know. But there was a feeling of hope, and you've got around that, you've got the millennium, you've got Britpop, you know, suddenly England is swinging once again. I mean, it was a, I know, we all know it was a sort of ersatz version of the 60s, you know, it was the Oasis rather than the Beatles. But and then the whole thing just goes horribly wrong. And he becomes a kind of international pariah. Not quite. I mean, I'm exaggerating, you know, and the story we tell is not necessarily the true story, but it's a very entertaining one of where he became, you know, I kind of thought to myself, if I was to bump into Tony Blair in the street, would you ask him for a selfie? You know, you probably wouldn't, would you? I mean, and so it's that thing. That's the story, really. And the way he then goes off and, you know, basically has this huge property portfolio and is photographed with various iffy people, shall we say, around the world. So that's what attracted me to it.
And, what's happening to the musical?
Well, you know, we ran it for 5 weeks there. So in many ways, that was enough for me to kind of exorcise the ghost of the X Factor flop. And so, although it was only 5 weeks in a 200-seater, I felt like it was a big success, actually. It was the team we had, the cast were fantastic. And, you know, the audiences really, really loved it every night. And we're now looking at, you know, transferring it somewhere else. I mean, all these things take a long time. Because of the lockdown, there's this huge bottleneck. It's a bit boring, but there's this huge bottleneck of shows. There's too many shows, not enough venues, because there's two things. The shows that were delayed have had to come back, you know, so the shows that were off have then come back into the places they were in. Plus, you've got everyone who was locked down has written a play.
There's a double whammy.
So it's a double whammy.
If you've moved on from, you feel like you've exercised what happened with the X Factor one, having done the Tony Blair one, is there another political musical in you? Is there a Boris Johnson musical? Have you been closely watching Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak?
Not Boris. Everyone says to me, what about Boris? I think it's too obvious. I don't know what you do with that. You know, it's almost beyond parody. I have got an idea for a musical, and if you like, I'll unpack it in front
Please
of your listeners, because I'm not sure about this. It's about Prince Charles and Camilla so they're king and queen, and but they've fallen out with the rest of the family, and so they hatch a plan to have a baby. So they bear with me, it's still there.
It's still here, yeah. I'm just writing it down.
So they hatch a plan to have a baby, and you know how that you can take these how the kind of age of fertility has been extended. They're like, I think the oldest lady to have a baby was 74. You know, you can take this course of hormones. So Camilla embarks on this course of and basically they conceive a child, and when the child is born, it is basically like a cross between Mr. Blobby and Mickey Mouse. It's a bizarre cartoon character. So it'll be someone. Okay, and so there's this dilemma about, you know, it's basically technically now. And I think the rest of the family had to get wiped out in a plane crash or something. But basically, it comes to the moment where basically this thing is next in line to the throne. But the weird thing is, actually, the public really, really like this creature. So it's sort of a comment about the nature of hereditary, the monarchy, basically.
The monarchy and the hereditary prison. Yeah. About there's a point, which just tips over to almost being treasonous, I think.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Are they still taking people in the Tower of London? is that maybe it is treason? Someone was done for treason recently, weren't they? There's arson in a naval dockyard that you can get hanged for.
You know more about these things than I did. There speaks the voice of experience. That speaks the voice.
My head on a pike outside the Tower of London, yeah, on London Bridge.
I was thinking, when I knew you were coming on, I wanted to ask you, because I was thinking, this thing with the Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak, has been dragging on for so long. And actually, in the good old days, when TV Burt was on, you'd have had an easy way to sort this out, wouldn't you?
I like Liz Truss, but I don't like Liz Truss, and I don't like Rishi Sunak. But which is better? Which is worse? There's only one way to find out. Fight! Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You can get it done in an afternoon.
Well, there's a lot to be said. You know, sometimes words are not enough, Matt.
You've never been tempted.
I tell you what, you get the ratings. Imagine the ratings. Instead of a live debate, just a live fight.
Just a fight.
Stripped down to a leotard. Rishi Sunak in high-waisted shorts and a cape fighting.
It'd be very expensive shorts as well and cape. Yeah. Sort of gold lined. Mm. You're not really. Your a lot of your comedy isn't really political. I mean, we spoke to your old mate Al Murray a few weeks ago, and obviously he stood for Parliament once. You've never been tempted by that.
I think he took a bit of a bruising in North. I think he forgot what the people of North Kent are actually like. You know, I'm from Kent, so I know he had a bit of a rough time with that, but Al, I don't do. Political humour. So the Tony Blair thing, I mean, with the Tony Blair thing, as you know, seeing it, it was kind of absurd. And I think we gave everyone a hard time. And my own kind of attitude really is that they're all as bad as each other, if I'm honest. It's a little bit, I'm afraid I'm a bit cynical about it. I've never met a politician I liked.
I don't... No, you're right. Well, I mean, I expect, you know, you and about 68 million other people, I suspect, have you?
And Tony Blair, Tony Blair's kind of to blame, this kind of cynicism towards politics. You know, a lot of it came about partly just because of the way that his kind of reliance on spin. And I mean, I know it was always there, but it seemed more obviously.
And also, I suppose,
more heavy handed.
And I have interviewed Tony, but I've asked about this, the fact that he came in on such a wave of everyone loving him, and he seemed like a great bloke, and he drank tea out of a mug, and he was normal. And that sort of the huge peak is also what then contributes to the sort of the crash afterwards, whereas up until that point, politicians were just sort of grey men in suits who...
That was it. Actually, we make that point, is that the reason... I mean, there have been plenty of, leaders worse than him, but the reason that everyone is so... vitriolic about him is that we had such hope for him.
Yeah.
Everyone was pinning so much on him, which was, foolish perhaps.
Yeah, it's a sort of the ex-boyfriend thing, isn't it? Everyone sort of fell in love with him and then, really hate him afterwards. Not that I've ever had an ex-boyfriend, but I can suspect. Harry Hill, it's been lovely to speak to you. What's your next thing? We've done art, we've done shows, we've done music, we've done comedy. What's next on the agenda for Harry Hill?
I'm going back to the old skill of stand-up comedy. Yeah, I'm going on tour in the autumn all around the country. I mean, in London, I'm doing Shepherd's Bush Empire. I'm doing my warm-ups for the tour at Wilton's Music Hall, I think would be a great place to see me. So do come along. Because, the lockdown, it all stopped. We weren't allowed to. I mean, I haven't toured for 10 years, so I don't tour very often. But once someone tells you you can't do it, it made me want to do it. So I'm back.
You're back. And Harry, it's been lovely to speak to you. Best of luck with all of it. And I look forward to seeing that extraordinary royal musical.
Got to come up with a name for it, haven't we?
On the stage of the London Palladium. You'll be back. It'll happen eventually. Harry Hill, thank you so much for joining us on Times Radio.
Cheers. My pleasure.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.